Reset, the podcast, is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand. Whether it's low alcohol or no alcohol, Liars helps you enjoy your classic favourite cocktails.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset, the podcast. A place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset.
In this latest Reset the Podcast, Suki talks to Russ Kane, the award-winning writer and broadcaster. Here is a man who defines what reset means, and during their chat, he shares the personal and the professional resets in his life. From losing his wife to cancer when his twin boys were 5 years old, to why a headline about suicide changed the course of his professional life over the past few years. Russ has met an extraordinary cast of characters on his journey, and you'll be amazed at who some of them are. His own take on the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune are fascinating to listen to. Suki and Russ also discuss why anger is often an energy that can be used positively, and perhaps the most moving and profound moment in their time together comes when Russ tells her why it's not the cards you were dealt, but how you play your hand. A very memorable piece of advice from a remarkable man.
Russ Kane, what an absolute joy to see you.
Well not a phrase I often hear when I turn up, but thank you very much. I'll absolutely take that. Definitely take that. You look well.
I'm very well, thank you. I am back in London from Cornwall, and actually I'm always happy when I'm feeling well. We're probably going to talk about that, won't we?
Yeah.
I obviously didn't know you at this time, but when I got to meet you, which was when you really kindly came to be part of my Let's Reset book, I knew of you because you were the voice of Capital Radio's Flying Eye. And for years, I used to drive into London, in the days you could drive into London, listening to Chris Tarrant and you on the
yep.
radio. Some of the people listening to this will be so young, they don't even know what the Flying Eye is.
They don't know what radio is. They won't know what radio is.
They don't even know what radio is. Tell me about that first bit of, well, it wasn't even the first bit of your life, but tell me, just tell us a little bit about what the Flying Eye was and did, just very briefly. But really,
I'm always delighted but fascinated. I mean, I stopped doing it in 2004. I did it for 20 years, 1984 to 2004. Yeah, I am that old, and I'm just fascinated that people still want to know about it. It's very sweet, very very nice. I never think about it, but it's nice. A Flying Eye was a twin-engined light aircraft, and we would fly over London. We'd do about 240 miles every day, looking at the traffic. It was before sat navs, it was before Garmin, it was before TomTom, any of that stuff. So I'd be flying along 1,000 feet, if you want to know what 1,000 feet is, if you live in London, the Canary Wharf, number one Canada Water, that is 800 feet. So that's how low we are. We're that low.
Wow.
At 1,000 feet. And I'd tell people, don't go down that road, or this is happening, or that's happening, and that was it. And we had 4 million listeners a day. 4 million. Unbelievable. People would kill for a fraction of that number now.
It's just extraordinary.
But it was another time. It was another era. It could never be replicated. It was huge fun.
Yeah.
And it made the radio station a fortune.
Yeah.
A fortune. The marketing side of it alone was just crazy.
Yeah.
It was huge fun. I loved it.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. Oh, and I remember it. And did you go into radio? Was that your first kind of job? Was that your life?
No, not at all. I had no desire to go into radio. I always loved radio. And I grew up with radio listening, this ages me, Sunday lunch times, we would listen to the Billy Cotton Band Show, Round the Horn, Beyond Our Ken, all of all that stuff that I love. That was the only family appointment time, me and mum and dad, and we listened to that on a Sunday. It was part of our lives, and I loved that. And then when I was at school, but he wasn't at the same school with me, there was my best pal when I was about 14 was Nicky Horn, who you will have heard of. And Nicky and I'd get on the bus to Palmer's Green, go over there, we were 14 years old, and we'd just make radio shows for our own amusement. No, didn't want to put it out to anybody, didn't want anybody else to listen to it. We never sent it anywhere. It was just for the sheer joy of doing it. And then I went into advertising, and that was that. And then I was approached to do the Flying Eye. And I said, I'll give it a go for two. I can't believe I said it. I said, first of all, I'll let you know. Can you believe doing that these days? I'll let you know. And it's just so ridiculous. And then I came back after a weekend thought, and I thought, I'll tell you what, I'll do it for 2 weeks, see if I like it. God almighty. And the 2 weeks lasted 20 years. And the guy who hired me was a lovely guy, and we're still really good friends. And he invented a little something, a little TV show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Amazing.
David Briggs. Yeah. And he couldn't sell that. He walked around for every TV company for two solid years. No one wanted it.
Really?
And then no one wanted it. They didn't get it. They thought it was rubbish. And eventually a guy, Mr. and Mrs. Paul Smith, not the fashion designers, Mr. and Mrs. Paul Smith ran a company, small company called Cellador, and they took it on and they changed the name from Cash Mountain to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. The rest is history, the most successful quiz show in the history of television.
Wow, but that's so fantastic, isn't it? So it took 2 years to do that.
Yeah, but it was based on the stuff we used to do at Capital. It was based on the quizzes that we used to do. It was called the Bong Show. Not bong as in drugs, but bong as in boom, you know, sounding a gong. So it was based on that, basically. We had the same writers, Mike Whitehill, Steve Knight. Steve Knight is now, how life changes. Steve Knight is now one of the top Hollywood scriptwriters. Top.
Wow.
You look at the movies, you see Steve Knight. He was in our press office. So we were just mates together. It's so weird how things work out. And then somebody else in our press office, she did quite right. She became the Duchess of Wessex.
Of course, yes.
Sophie. So Sophie and I, you know, she was great. She was Sophie Rhys-Jones. We were just all pals together. And then life kind of takes you in different directions. And it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It is, isn't it? So I guess so that was, you know, that was an extraordinary time, 4 million listeners. And I guess, you know, the name of this podcast is Reset. At that time as well, you must have had a big reset, because in your personal life, you'd had the twins, Sally, your wife got cancer. Tell us a little bit about that moment and the impact that then had on you.
It sucks. That's all you need to know. Has no upside to it whatsoever. Yeah, the twins were very premature. They were crazy premature. My wife nearly died. She lost 70 units of blood. It all went horribly, horribly wrong. I was taken in to say goodbye to her, effectively. It was disgusting. The one thing you never want to hear in a hospital is people running.
Yeah.
You don't want to hear people running. I was waiting. It was going on and on and on. And I thought, what the hell? My premonition was that this was all going to go drastically wrong. The kids weighed 3 pounds each, and they were in hospital for ages. They were in one hospital in incubators, trying to keep them alive. Sally was in a coma for over a week. And I was in another hospital. Then I had a huge car crash. So eventually, at one point, we were in three different London hospitals. It was crap. So, and then one of the little guys, his lungs burst. I mean, Jesus, it was unending. I had to learn to walk again after my car crash. It was, you know, it was fun. But then we all got together and all worked out okay. And then she got breast cancer, and then she recovered from that. And then 4 years later, she died. And the twins were five. So, yeah, we had to reset.
Wow. I mean, it sounds so trite to say, how on earth did you reset your life? And I'm wondering if part of that reset has led you into doing your men and women's radio station. But
before we come on and talk about that, how did you reset? What things did you do?
I didn't have a choice. People said, oh, isn't that brave? Isn't that marvellous? Isn't it this and that? Well, no, you've got two choices. You can lie in the gutter and die, or you get on with it. I had twins. They were 5 years old. I didn't have a choice. End of. That was it. I had to get on.
Yeah.
Simple. You know, I can't really break it down much more than that. It had to be done.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, my priority was them.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was my priority.
Yeah. And they're 23 now, aren't they? James and Charles.
Yeah. I never talk about them publicly with their names. So because they're very low key, they won't even go on social media. They're very low key. And they did all right. One went to Oxford, read English literature, and one's just finished and he got a first in mechanical engineering. So, yeah, they're pretty good. And they're 6'3".
Wow.
Huge.
Well done.
And
well done, Dad.
And, well, no, not me. I had a hell of a lot of help. Somebody came into my life and with the most thankless job in the world and helped me raise them. And, you know, without that person, I think it would have probably been a different story. But you just have to be determined and just have to get on. I mean, that's it. It's not the cards you are dealt. It's how you play your hand. That's what it's about. You have no control over the cards. And the one thing I never said, and my late wife never said, you can't say, why me? The real question is, why not me? It's a random lottery. There's no rhyme. There's no reason. There's no big plan. Shit happens. Stuff happens. Life happens. And you have to deal with it. And that's it. There is no guarantee it's going to be fair. There's no guarantee it's going to be happy. It just is. And you've got to make the best of it. And that's really my philosophy.
Well, it's an amazing philosophy to have.
Well, no, I don't see what the alternative is. I mean, it's very sweet of you to say that, but I don't see what the alternative is.
Well, I think for amazingly positive people like you, there isn't an alternative. But I think that, you know, it does take a lot of time and effort and mental resilience to keep being positive, to keep moving forward, to keep them there. You know, and I think, you know, all of us can sleepwalk through our lives. All of us can take the really big or not as big as perhaps you knocks that we have and let that get in the way of us being able to achieve the life that we want.
Hmm.
And it is a choice. Of course it is a choice. It's a choice that we can individually make to either, as you say, go, do you know what? I'm not going to let this get me to not do things. I'm going to grab it and keep going forward.
But, you know, understand that doesn't mean I wasn't grieving. I wrote an article for a newspaper a few weeks back and I called it "There's No Statute of Limitations on Grief." And I went to a grief counsellor, which I have to be honest with you, I found useless, but that was just me because you go through these stages. I was very angry, but I used that anger. The anger's good. You know, what was it? Public Image Limited, John Lydon. Anger is an energy. And I believe that, you know, you can let anger eat you up or you can just use it as a fuel, which I did, and continue to do so. So, you know, I was talking about grief and the grief counsellor said, well, one day's too short and a lifetime's too long. And that's true. I thought that was the best thing I took away from that. And you learn to live with it. It never goes away. But I liken it really in terms of the reset. That if you know, when you've got a migraine, if you've ever had a migraine, you just want to smash your head against a brick wall because it'll be less painful than the migraine and you can't do anything. And if you've got a headache, it hurts a bit. And then eventually it goes to sort of like a dull, low little resonance and you can cope with that. That's fine. And I think that's what grief is really. You know, it's always there, but you learn to just compartmentalize it. And that's what you do. Well, yeah. That's what I did.
And I can see. So, you know, you talked a little bit then about anger and fueling things that you then went on to do. Tell me specifically about your 2019, your desire with Howard Jameson to create women's radio station and a men's radio station, to particularly talk about very broadly mental health.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I've known Howard Jameson, who's a lovely man, quite unique. And he runs the German Street Theatre. He didn't know anything about radio. And he, we were chatting away, and he said, I've started women's radio. And I went, well, good luck with that. So I started to have a look at it. I said, Howard, this is, with respect, this is all wrong. Let me help, because people taking advantage. So I sort of came in and helped him out, thought no more about it. I would, because he's been a pal of mine for years and years and years. And then one day, and this is pure serendipity, I was doing the newspaper review for the BBC. And the headlines could have been anything. Could have been Brexit, you know, man lands on Mars. It could have been whatever you like. And it happened to be the suicide statistics of the United Kingdom. Not a subject I knew anything about. Mm. And I was shocked to read that it was 80% men, 20% women. And I thought, my God, that can't be right. And then I went through all the newspapers, as I had to do for my job, to review them. And it was saying that the main problem is where men won't talk out. You know, grow a pair, big boys don't cry, all that sort of nonsense. Grow up, you know, man up. And women, not only can they multitask better than we ever could, but when they go out with their pals and they say, Suki, how are you? And you would say, well, boom, boom, boom. You'd be right. Blokes go, yeah, right, mate, fine. They're not fine. And bottling it all up leads to depression, and then it can eventually lead to having a horrible ultimate effect. And I spoke to Howard, and I said, this is nuts. We've got to do something about it. So over in a greasy spoon, it's funny, when I talk about it to the American audience, they go, greasy spoon? I have to explain what a greasy spoon is. Then I have to explain that I was sitting on a formica table. The whole thing takes a huge detour into British culture. So we were Soho or somewhere. So we're in a greasy spoon over a coffee, and we just shook hands and said, let's do this. So we did. And the whole basis has been the handshake. It's another of my things. If you've got to have huge legal things, it's not worth doing. If you're going into it on the basis that someone's going to screw you, don't start the business. Simple philosophy. So we did it all in the handshake, and we had no idea where it's going to go. And it's just grown like Topsy. You know, we've been very lucky. We've won a load of awards. So Howard started Men's Radio, which I'm a director of now, in Jan 2018. We started Men's Radio in January 2019. We had studios and everything. And then, of course, the pandemic came, and I shut the studio because I didn't think it was safe for our staff, certainly not safe for our guests, but much more important, not safe for me. So I thought, I'm not going in there. And we used new technology, and the technology has been brilliant, apart from I screwed up today. But that's where we're at. And we talk about mental health and well-being. To my amazement and joy, 50% of our audience are female. It's not, yeah, because, you know, people go, oh, do you talk about cars? And no, of course we don't. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that. It's not 1972. God's sake. It's talking about mental illness, and most of our guests are female as well. It's extraordinary. And we've had counsellors, psychiatrists, psychoanalysts. I mean, all these people, plus a lot of people who are talking about their personal experiences. Today's show, I decided to talk about depression, had people on who were living through it, and people are willing to talk. They're much more open. It's a I don't like safe space, Suki, because that's too Californian. Oh, I want a safe space. What I wanted to create was a non-judgmental space. So you come on, and it's not my job to try and trip you up. It's not my job to make myself look clever. It's not about me. It's about you. It's their show. It's the public's show. I think of myself really as just a conduit between them and the broadcast medium.
Yeah, I can see that. And actually, I've been on your show a couple of times, and it's actually a joyful experience.
Thank you.
Because it's kind of fun as well. And you, and that's what I like about it. You're dealing with, you know, very difficult, serious topics, as you say, some very personal conversations. But I think because you are both warm but funny, it really, really helps. And I think there's something around what I love. Mental health, on the whole, people go, oh, that's all about people feeling really bad, and you know, it's very serious, so we can't laugh, we can't have a joke, that's what we need to do. And actually, I think what you've shown through the show is you can do both, and even people, even people with depression can still laugh. Just because you've got depression doesn't suddenly mean that you don't laugh anymore. It's just there's a lot of other stuff going on as well.
Well, you know what? We're dealing with huge things, suicide, all sorts of issues, some much more lighthearted. But even in the serious issues, you can't have hour after hour of, you know, people going, oh, this is terrible. I mean, who the hell wants to listen to that? Nobody. So even when it's very, very serious, you've got to just interject, sprinkle it with who, you know, who we are. The other thing is, I deliberately did not want it to be the BBC before everyone goes, ooh. What I meant was I didn't want a soundbite. If you're talking about suicide prevention, you don't want to go, well, that was Dr. Suki, thanks very much, and now summer fashion. You can't do that. You've got to give the people the proper space and the time to do it at their own pace. So everybody gets like 20 minutes, half an hour. If things are going really, really well, you know, maybe an hour.
Yeah.
Whatever they need. You can't, you know, do this stupid soundbite nonsense. It just doesn't help. It doesn't help move the conversation on.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can completely see that. No, and where do you see it going? What's the, do you have an ambition? Do you have a kind of, this is what I think?
Do I have an ambition? Well, yeah. I don't know. I would like it to be out there more. You know, I'd like to be helping. I'd like for some of our shows to be on NHS websites, for example, or available for people. You know, the specific things. I'm trying to build up like a library of stuff. So if you've got a specific problem, you can go to that and maybe listen to a show, and just to signpost people, because we're not experts. I never ever give advice, ever. It's not my job. It would be completely wrong of me. And I've never said that, but we can point people in the right direction, because I think people just get so lost. Let's say, well, you should try and talk to them or reach out to those people. So signposting is becoming more and more and important. And the NHS, of course, is being crushed under the pressure of COVID. Waiting lists for everything is going through the roof. And if you've got mental issues, you're pretty much at the back. It's difficult. You know, they're time critical. So we're trying to, I don't know, we're doing what we can to help. It's as simple as that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a great idea, actually. And I love the idea of signposting, and maybe there's something we can do at Let's Reset with some of the content that we've got that could signpost to some of your programs. I think
that, well, thank you. That would be great.
Yeah, we'll definitely have a look at that. Also, you know, you've done lots of other things. You've done a one-man stand-up show.
Yeah.
Why did you do that? Well, I mean, honestly, I went to drama school, and I was not a very good actor. But the thing that I feared more than anything else in our last year is we had to do like a 10-minute stand-up show that was meant to be funny. I mean, it was literally the worst thing I've ever done in my whole life. Why and how do you enjoy doing that?
I'm not sure enjoys them. Many, many, many years ago, I stupidly agreed to be on the South Bank show, that Melvin Bragg thing.
Oh, yeah.
It was called the A to Z of comedy. I'm going back a billion years. And I was taken out for a very liquid and rather grand lunch by all the producers. And they wanted to follow me around. And then eventually someone who'd never done stand-up would perform at Jongleurs.
Yes.
And in front of four cameras on a Friday night. And I lost a stone in the lead-up to it. And in the immortal words of Julie Burchill, not since Lee Harvey Oswald has one person died in front of so many people. It was the worst professional experience of my life. It was awful. And then I had to come off stage wanting to just shoot myself. And how was it, Russ? How was it going? Oh, it was great. I mean, you know, just lying. And eventually Melvin Bragg decided he needed to be in the show, so we were all cut out. all of that for nothing. I tell you this, it was so bad, Suki. I stayed in bed for 2 days under the duvet. And then I got a call from the producers. Hey, we've looked at the early rushes. I went, oh, Christ, here we go. No, we've re-edited it, put a laughter track under it. You look sensational. It's fantastic. We've got reaction shots. The audience are falling about. And then everything, me and Barry Cryer, we all ended up on the cutting room floor. So I went through that. So I wouldn't do stand-up for another 20 years. Wouldn't touch it. And then I was in, bringing sort of almost full circle from another story. I was in the German Street Theatre. I was in town. So I always go to annoy the lady who runs it, Penny Horner. I just go in and have a cup of tea. We just rip into each other, know each other forever. And we're sitting there and some fella comes in, sort of Napoleonic uniform, you know, which is, I'm just going on stage to run through some of my lines. It was all terribly lovely. And off he went. It's lunchtime, right? I can't take that seriously at all. I'm not being rude about actors, but it's just not me, right? And I said, oh, yeah, Penn. I said, I can't wait for my one-man show. And she said, it's about effing time you did it. And she stood up with a Sharpie in her hand, went up to the schedule of the German Street Theatre and wrote it down. She said, right, you're on.
Thought, oh, my God, that's amazing.
Yeah. So I thought, shit. So I had like a few months to put it together. And talk about sink or swim. It was an hour and a half. I decided I'd do an hour and a half. I never do anything by half. Hour and a half show. 45-minute halves. Oh
my God.
And it went ridiculously well, to my utter amazement. Sold out. Done it a few times at German Street. All sold out. And then me being me, I thought, you know what? I want to do this in Los Angeles. I never think small. So everyone said, well, you don't have an agent, don't have a manager. How the hell are you going to get out to LA? I said, I'm just going to do it. And I spoke to my pals in LA. I said, recommend a venue. And I found the Santa Monica Playhouse. I went on the Santa Monica website, right? Oh, you've got to send a script. I mean, there were so many barriers. And I thought, oh, sod this. So I just wrote them an email. 20 minutes later, I had a reply. Yeah, I would love to have you. Sounds great. So I went out to Santa Monica, not knowing a soul. And LA, they never want to be behind the curve with anything. Completely sold out. It was so sold out, they had to put extra seats on the stage. So I've done it six times out in LA. And then the next thing was, I thought, what haven't I done? I know, Edinburgh Fringe. Sod it, why not? What do I know about the Edinburgh Fringe? Nothing, never even been to Edinburgh. So signed up to do the Edinburgh Fringe. And this is how stupid I am. I think if you're really stupid, things work out, right? I thought, they said, well, we'll send you the brochure, you know, of all the acts. So I'm expecting like something from your local Indian takeaway, you know, like four sides, right? This thing arrives. It's gigantic. There are 3,000 acts. They sell 3.5 million tickets. And I looked at this huge tome and I thought, oh, Jesus, what the hell have I got into? Anyway, I did my Edinburgh run, had a blast. I enjoyed it. You know, what the hell? So I've done it. You know, it was fun.
Oh, such a great.
I think the thing to do is just give things a go. You know?
Yeah.
Give it a go.
That's so interesting, isn't it? You know, I love your, well, one, that the bit between going, I'm going to just try something, and then I'm not just going to do it like in a little way. I'm going to go big.
I have to. And,
you know, which is that what you're always like? Are you,
I can't.
I could help a little bit around mental health. You go, no, I'm going to do a whole radio station.
Yeah, I know. It is ridiculous. It is ridiculous, but I can't be bothered putting in the time and the effort. If you're going to do something small, the same time and effort, you might as well, you know, go big or go home. And that's just it. Because, you know, my late dad is, I'd be worried. He says, what are they going to do? They're going to take you out in the street and shoot you. I went, well, of course not. He goes, well, there you go. So anything above that is a plus.
No, I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree.
Although standing in the wings, it's interesting what you were saying about your drama school and everything. You know, when I stand in the wings before I go on, knowing there's an hour and a half and you can't blame anyone else. It's not the music. It's not the set. It's not the director, the producer. It's just you. You and your material. And you live or die by it. And I stand there and I think, what the hell am I doing? Why am I doing it? Why? And then my silly play on music comes on and, you know, you launch into it.
Yeah.
And also American audiences are so different from English audiences. It's like I write a different show for LA.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, totally. Write a different show. It's fun.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And so, you know, one of the things that we measure a lot is the seven needs of well-being and performance. And the last one is all around purpose. Mm. And I'm fascinated if you have, you clearly have a sense of, you know, fun and making a difference and doing things in a big way. Would you say that you have a sense of purpose? And if so, what is it?
Oh, I wish I could. You know, it would sound marvellous, but I'm really chaotic. If I get out of bed, it's a start. If I make it through the day, it's a result. Honestly, I wish I could say, I've got to the stage, I make lists. I always have a list at my stand-up desk. I don't sit down, I have a stand-up desk because that helps a lot. And I go through and I go work through my list. And that does... that gives you a sense of satisfaction. All right, I got rid of that crap. All right, that's gone. All right, I've spoken to that one. You know, all the, it might even be, you know, go out and buy, you know, some more washing up liquid. It doesn't matter. If it's not on the list, it won't get done because my head is like, I wish I could say it's organized. It's like a firework display. So I'm writing my second novel now, and that's taking me forever. That was another thing. I wanted to write a book. So I thought, yeah. So I wrote 20,000 words.
Right.
And then all the publishers came back and said, oh, can you make it? This is life, right? You know, can you make it dark? What? I set out to write a comedy. I went, yeah. Oh, they all came back. Every publisher, can you make it dark? I went, well, how dark? And they went, well, dark as you want to go. So I threw away 20,000 words, just threw them away, started again. It's called The Gatekeeper, and I loved writing that. And my new one's called Invasion, and I am struggling. I'll be absolutely honest. The whole pandemic did my head in. I just could not be creative. And running the radio stations, I found it. So it's on a bit of a hiatus. I'm a year behind schedule. My literary agent is not the happiest man on the planet.
No.
There's nothing I can do. I can't, you know, it's a great story, but... I love the story, and I've worked out the ending. So I've written the end,
beginning and end.
Well, at least I know. I couldn't work out how to end it. It was also driving me mad. So every Saturday, we have what called the Secret Cigar Trio. There's me, there's a jazz player, and a Hollywood producer. The three of us meet every Saturday for a cigar and coffee. Every Saturday, and during lockdown, we couldn't sit anywhere. So we'd stand in the churchyard in the rain under umbrellas. We didn't care. Just had to meet up and see if we were all kept us sane. You know, it was a rough period for everybody, but that kept us sane. That's my Saturday routine. Coffee, cigar. That's it.
Coffee and cigar. That's
yeah,
just,
I know. Crazy enough. But that's what keeps us. And, no, and people say, can we come? No. Just the three. No, you can't come.
Yeah.
You can't come. No.
Yeah. One of the things we're doing at the moment is we're just highlighting and talking to some of the people that have been in the Let's Reset book and how they've coped with the pandemic. So we know one of the things you've done is stood in the rain with your cigar and your best mates. I love your comment about what you've done to look after your well-being and performance. And that's around the negative thoughts. And, you know, this is something that so many people have really struggled with, and we talk about it a lot. Tell us your tip for getting...
I'll show you my tip. It's this. And this is... I was so impressed. This guy was a guest of mine, and I was so impressed. He's now got his own series on the... And it's called Monkey Mind... What were we called? It's Monkey Mind Relaxation. And you can do this with an elastic band, right? You get those negative thoughts, but this is like a little sweet little band, and you just... And it hurts. But that physical thing is going, you know, I don't need this crap in my life. Stop it. Go away. Or I stand in my kitchen and literally tell it to F off. I mean, literally aloud, because they are negative thoughts. And you just go snap. And it's, you know, it's a reset. It's exactly what you're doing. It's a reset. Many of the experts we've had on, we talk about catastrophizing. In other words, people lie awake at night. This is going to, that's going to, this. 95% of the terrible things you think are going to happen to you never happen. 95%. All the experts say exactly the same thing. Some of the bad things, duh, don't I know, will happen. 95% won't. And we are our own worst enemies. Those negative thoughts are awful. So, snap, the guy's name is Cuddy Cudsworth. Cuddy Cudworth. And I thought it was genius.
That's such
it's true. Idea. But it's all about resetting. It's exactly what you're about. It's like, why have I got these? Where are they coming from? Who is this little voice? I don't need this. I've got stuff to do. Or even if I just want to watch TV and do nothing, shut up, go away. Don't need you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that actually, if the more you practice it, the more your brain goes, okay, when I tell you to go away, it is, you're going to have to go away.
You're going
to
go.
You get better at it, don't you?
And I get quite aggressive with it. Seriously, because I don't want it. And you can't help it. It's not you're doing it deliberately. It just creeps in. You're no good. You're rubbish. You're going to fail. This is going to happen. You're going to end up under Waterloo Bridge. Whatever. All the things, you know. And you just kind of go, which sounds so simple and stupid, but it's like, hang on, I don't need it.
Yeah.
So I can reset.
Love that reset. Really love that reset. What else have you had to reset during the last 18 months? And there's been a lot.
Learning. Yeah, I mean, we were under house arrest, weren't we? I mean, that's what the only thing that missing was electronic ankle tags. And it was horrible. It was horrible. I've had to learn. Well, I've always tried to, in my personal life, I don't need big things. I'm not into things, you know. I did all that when I was much younger, and it meant something to me. It means zero to me now. You know, my peace of mind is much more important than having stuff. I don't need. I got rid of nearly everything. Tried to minimalize it. Not the biggest success. Not the biggest success. But it's like finding pleasure in the small stuff. So oddly enough, I mean, this sounds so weird because I've always worked from home, right? Apart from when I was in advertising in the ad agencies. But so I've worked for them for many years. Finding pleasure in really small stuff, like going out for a coffee, if you could, even if it was a takeaway, you had to sit on a park bench.
Yeah,
that was okay. That was okay. Walking my dog, love that. You know, peace of mind. Listening to loads and loads of audiobooks. And finding that very relaxing and very pleasurable and enjoying that. You know, you can't go on holiday. You can't go, well, I have no plans. I couldn't face traveling in all of this utter madness. I'm not sure it's ever going to come back, to be honest. And I'll tell you why I say that, because taxation, apart from Robin Hood and all of that, sort of, you know, Sheriff of Nottingham, taxation was brought in to pay for the Napoleonic War. Well, call me crazy. I think with the Napoleonic Wars done, we're finished now, and we're still being taxed. So these things, which they always, you know, governments of any hue and persuasion say, oh, we're just going to, it's a temporary measure. Temporary, yeah, right. Sure it is. That scares the hell out of me.
Different conversation, but it absolutely, I'm sure, scares me as well. Gosh.
Yeah, I mean, so traveling, I don't know. So again, resetting how you have to look, your landscape has shifted, your horizon has narrowed, but it doesn't mean our dreams have to, I think. That's kind of how I think about it. And just enjoying the small stuff, because the big stuff just is not, you can't do it. So you recalibrate. That's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right. I don't have a major problem with that.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? I was talking to somebody this morning about looking at photographs of their holidays. Mm. And they were saying, oh, you know, of course, you know, nobody wants to see pictures of other people's holidays. I'm like, yes, I do. I'm like, I really want to see any pictures of anyone being on holiday. It's so exciting again, isn't it?
See, I'm useless on holiday. I can't sit on the beach. Can't do it. I don't know what to do with myself.
Well, I don't
know what to do with myself. It drives me nuts.
No. Have you ever sat still at all? No.
I find it hard. Not because I've got things to do. I just find it very hard to be still. Unless I'm watching TV. It's I don't go to bed till it's shot. I've got into a terrible habit. I go to bed about 3 or 4 every morning. Every morning.
What time do you get up?
I don't know. 9-ish. Depends. Depends what I got on. But I mean, it's not good. I'll probably drop, but that's how I am. I can't pretend that, you know, it's just how I am. I find it difficult to sleep. But going on holiday, if I'm going to my end of holidays, going to LA and seeing pals and, you know, different food, different climate, or something like that. My idea of hell is going to a hotel and sitting by a pool.
Yeah.
Horrible. I wouldn't know what to do.
No, I'm not very good.
It's just dreadful. I just don't like it. No. It doesn't relax me.
So what do you do to switch off? I mean, you said a little bit, you listen to it. Because I do think, and you're in a, you have a whole radio station about this. We do know that your mental health is really important. You're good at getting rid of those, you know, dangerous words in your head that you don't want there. Mm. What else do you do for your mental and physical
health? I'm not correcting you, but I don't want people to think, oh, he's cured the evil little voices. I haven't.
No.
But I recognize it and I take steps to tell them to piss off. That's as scientific as I can get. I wish I could say I never have them all, you know, and I'm, you know, Tony Robbins talking to the, you know, the NEC or something. That's not me. I'm just saying I've learned to find coping mechanisms, which is fine. So your question was how do I switch off how do I relax?
How do you look after your kind of physical and mental well-being?
During lockdown, I was very sweet. There was a personal trainer up in Stoke-on-Trent who was an old friend of mine, and she couldn't, you know, her business obviously was hugely affected. So she trained me twice a week. I'd never done training before. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, I'm going to be the worst person you've ever taken on because I'm totally unfit and I hate it. And she really worked wonders. That was great. And I miss it now, of course. Lockdown's finished, so she's got her proper clients. So I can't see her anymore. But, you know, I walk 3 miles a day minimum, time I finish dragging my dog, who has to stop at every bloody blade of grass. She is the most irritating. Yes. She's 12 now.
What sort of dog have you got, Russ?
She's a mini schnauzer. She rules my entire world. I have so many T-shirts all about mini schnauzers. It's ridiculous. Today I'm wearing my Men's Radio shirt because that'd be a good plug. There we go. See, Men's Radio, I call it Radio for Grown-Ups. She's a mini schnauzer. So I walk about at least 3 miles a day. I listen to my audiobooks. I love it. It really, really relaxes me. I find that's getting into those things. It's marvelous. There's some fantastic ones. I've put my headset on. I'm my own little world. And that's kind of what I do.
What's one of the favourite books you've listened to in the last few months?
Easy Peasy Lemon Squeezy. Anything by Anthony Horowitz. Anthony Horowitz is my writing hero. To my utter amazement, we connected on Twitter.
Ooh.
And we've become sort of pals. And he's like writing God to me. And he came to my book launch. I couldn't believe it. He walked in. I was absolutely, I thought I was going to faint.
Russ, wow.
I thought I was going to faint. And I'm going, okay, it's Anthony Horowitz. I'm going, oh my God. And, you know, I was trying to be cool. And inside, I'm like 8 years old. And he's such a nice man. And we kind of chit-chat on Twitter away. And his book, Moonflower Murders, was great. The series of books he does where he himself is one of the characters, the sentence, what is it? Sentence is death, word is murder. Any of those things, they're just great. I love him. Absolutely love him. He is brilliant. If I could write a tenth as cleverly as he does. And there's another writer I really like. And I reach out yesterday, to my amazement, I was followed on Twitter by Patricia Cornwell.
Really?
The creator of Scarpetta.
Another of my favourites. That's amazing.
I nearly died of excitement.
Yeah.
I phoned up my other half and go, guess what? Even she was impressed.
Was she?
There's a fantastic writer called Sophie Hannah. She's a great writer. She's very good. Ellie Griffith, another great writer. I've enjoyed all of their work. And you know Baldrick?
Yes.
Tony Robinson. He has a daughter. Yes. I get into the sentence then. You go, what the hell was that about? He has a daughter called Laura Shepherd Robinson, I think it is. Laura Robinson. And she wrote a book, which I just like the look of, called Blood and Sugar. And that was clever. It's a sort of historical drama. It was very good. That was her first book. I thought it was great.
Okay, well, that's a good list. That's a very good
one. There you go. Those are the books that I've liked.
Brilliant. Well, I'm always up for some more books, but I completely agree. Horowitz, brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant.
He is brilliant, and his rate of production is just like, what the hell? How does he do this?
You know? He's not worried on a Saturday morning that he hasn't been able to write enough words, is he?
It is extraordinary. And the most charming, charming, he said, why don't we have a drink? We met up a couple of Christmases. You know, he was just the most charming, down-to-earth guy.
Isn't it lovely when people that you really, really admire are also really lovely people?
Really nice. It's quite extraordinary. You know, there's things like Unforgotten. You know that series with Sanjeev Bhaskar, Unforgotten?
Oh, yeah.
I love that series with the sainted Nicola Walker, who's like my favourite actress. So it's written by a guy called Chris Lang. And I don't know Chris Lang. And we speak to each other, you know, digitally every single day. And he's the most normal dad. And I go, but you created Unforgotten, for Christ's sake. Gee, it's like a genius. I didn't come up with that. And it's lovely when people are just completely, and then, of course, the converse is true. I always find the people with the least talent are the most unpleasant and revolting. Mm-hmm. If you ever meet people from reality shows, you go, oh, God, shut up. Shut up, you idiot.
I met, I'm not going to say who it is, obvious reasons. There was a fashion designer who was in Asia who I absolutely adored, loved the clothes, loved the person, and then had dinner with a few years ago with a few others. Oh, so disappointed. Just, he was horrible. I mean, literally.
Horrible person.
Just a horrible person. And I was so gutted. But, you know. But
It's interesting, though. Did that, I'm just interested in the psychological, did that then skew your views of the fashion designs? And because you think, I don't want to wear that stuff because he's horrible.
Yeah, and I just thought, no, I was so disappointed. And actually, I had met him a long time ago when he was very young, at the beginning of his career, and amazing. Mm. And I just thought, that whole time has completely not made you from going to being a young, exciting, you know, nice person to being just a horrible.
We discuss this a lot on Men's Radio. And I have a view, you know, it's like, it's an extension of the phrase in vino veritas. You know, when people say, oh, I'm sorry, I was drunk, I didn't mean it. No. If you were a racist, you were a racist. All the drink has done is enabled you to open your stupid mouth and spew racist abuse. Saying you were drunk is no excuse. Saying you were drunk and you started beating somebody up is no excuse. It was in you to start with. And I genuinely believe when people become monsters, when they're very, very famous, they were always like that. It's just that the fame and the money and the people who protect them because they need that cash cow, it lets you get away with it. I think if you're a decent person, you could become hugely successful and still be, well, look at Andy Horowitz, for goodness sake. That's in just one area. You know, probably one of the most successful authors, television writers. He's charming. He hasn't become a monster. You don't have to. They don't go hand in hand. I think it's within you to start with. I think you were always an a-hole, and now you've got the money and the fame, and you're an even bigger a-hole. That's it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, we see this in terms of famous people. We also see it a lot in leaders of businesses, that some remain with integrity and genuinely nice people. I mean, everyone has to make tough decisions, but you can do it in different ways. And others, as you say, they just believe. They believe their own bullshit, and there's nobody around to say to them, do you know what? You just become a horrible person. So why don't you either stop it or, as you say, probably were already, so there's nothing to be done. But
it is. There's no need to be like that. There's never a need. You know, I've always said it takes just as much time to be horrible as it does to be nice. So I don't see. There's a wonderful example of the actor Richard Dreyfuss. We're going to need a bigger boat. And Richard Dreyfuss famously for decades would never sign an autograph, was very grumpy. And then he suddenly thought, what the hell am I doing? And he regrets it totally now.
Yeah, it's funny.
He regrets it, you know.
Yeah, I love the phrase, you can catch more flies with sugar than salt.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great.
Absolutely.
So then just finally, I wonder, you know, we talked a lot about the mental health radio and some of the things we've seen, and we've seen in the last 18 months a real focus on mental health, just the importance of being able to speak openly, create environments. Do you think that, I'm particularly interested in business, do you think that business over the next period of time will be able to embrace this a lot more, be able to create environments where people are able to talk about mental health? And, you know, I'm very cognizant of your point and the data around particularly middle-aged men. You know, it's still suicide is still the most likely thing to cause men to die than anything.
It is. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's just horrific.
There's also, by the way, Suki, there's a reason for that. And I'm sorry, I'm not being graphic, but it's a fact. If women say they're going to end their lives, they'll do it in a way, sometimes it's a bit half-hearted. Please don't take offense, but they will survive. Guys tend to be very dramatic, and they will do something where you cannot get it wrong. It's like once you commit to whatever that act is, it's going to be final, and you will die. And that's why the death rate is much higher. I'm not saying in the suicide attempts, forgive me, but that's one of the statistics that all the experts we've had on the shows, you know, have all said exactly the same thing. You know, if you're going to throw yourself under a train, you're not going to come away with a broken finger. That's it. It's finished. Yeah. I mean, and the other side of that coin, sorry, then I'm going to answer your question, is because we had experts on from train drivers unions and stuff like that. For the person who's ended their life, it's over. The poor sod driving that train never gets over it. Never. And you don't think about that. You don't think about that.
No.
It's another side.
Anyway, well, it is actually. And just on that very quickly, because did you see on, I think it was on Good Morning Britain, the amazing man who was on the station, who's just a station attendant, who has talked, I think there was, I mean, like more than 10 people away from taking their own life by throwing themselves under a train.
Yeah.
And you go, you know, those people, one, what an extraordinary man, but also that must be replicated in so many places.
It is huge. And do you know, it comes back because when that person, that rail employee, whatever it is, pulls the would-be person who wanted to end their lives away, I think they will suddenly say, the hell was I doing? What the hell was I doing? And because it's a decision that is just horrific and irrevocable. Now, to answer your question, mental health, we have a dedicated show, Mental Health in the Workplace. It's with Alexander Lichtenfeld, who's an expert in that field. It has to be. I guess the way that I think of it is you wouldn't have an office or a factory without a first aid kit, and you wouldn't have an office or a factory without a fire extinguisher. I mean, you just wouldn't. You probably got them in your home. So eventually we will get to the stage where I think mental health, you know, even if you're the most cynical person in the world, and I've asked this question because everyone's struggling, the economy's been, you know, kicked, and God knows if it's going to restart properly, et cetera, et cetera. So everyone's worried about the bottom line. If your staff are not functioning properly, it's going to have a huge adverse effect on your business. So even if I'm being really rude, but even if you couldn't give a monkey's about mental health, it's in your financial interest to make sure that your staff are okay, because then they can function properly and you get full productivity. I mean, if you took the most cynical view of it, if you took a more benevolent view, you'd still want that. You know, the old adage, sorry, mate, you're on 9 to 5, you leave all your shit at the front door, you do your job, I don't care what happens from 5 o'clock onwards, not my problem. That kind of has to shift. That has to shift, and I think it is. But also, Suki, it's so important that trust is an element. Because if you can't trust the person you confide in, you're screwed. Because at the back of people's mind, well, if I go to speak to, you know, Maureen in HR or Fred Smith in whatever it is, these mental health first aiders, and they then go to my boss and say, I'll tell you what, Russell's he's a bit shaky. I won't give him that big deal that we're trying to close. Because, you know, that's going to, you can't have that. It has to be sacrosanct.
Yes.
It really does. The last bastion to fall will be the city, the financial sector, because you talk about one group of unpleasant people. I'm sorry. I used to write for these guys. I've never met people like it. I had to be an absolute monster to get. I became a monster. I became worse than them so they could deal with me. And it worked perfectly. It wasn't a monster in my life, but in the meetings, there was a huge, I mean, this is what you're dealing with, Suki. I was a huge company. They had 1,000 partners coming to Paris. I was writing all the main plenary speeches to start the four-day conference off. Couldn't get an appointment with the guy. Couldn't get an appointment. Eventually, I go and see this fellow. It's a huge company. I won't say which it is. And he started treating me like I'd come to change the toner on his photocopier. You know, I'm sitting in the office getting nowhere and I've got to write the speech. And I said, Mr. Jones, can I just draw your attention to something so we can focus in? He looked at me like I said, in 3 weeks' time, one of the two of us in this room is standing up in front of 1,000 of his colleagues to address them. And his career will be judged on that performance. And here's a little clue for you. It's not me. And boom, I had, you know, he got the point. So had I sat there and been, well, you know, if you can't give me your, because I would have got the blame for writing a lousy speech. So it's important, you know, mental health in the workplace. Yeah, it's got to be done, but it can't. The big companies, I mean, I like to live in the real world, you know, not the theoretical world. The huge companies can pay lip service to this and it all looks marvelous and et cetera. But say you're a motorbike repair shop, pick something small. You're working in an arch somewhere in King's Cross or whatever, and you've got six people coming in. You've got to do that as well.
Yeah.
They're not going to pay lip service, but they've got to look after, you know, it cascades all the way down.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we are seeing increasingly some fantastic examples of both large and small companies doing amazing things. But as you say, Russ, there is a way to go.
It's a huge, huge way to go, you know. But think of it this way. People always get very impatient. Drinking and driving, right?
Yeah.
My dad's era, you go one for the road. You know, you'd always say, hey, let's have one for the road. That's what it took two generations for that to be completely unacceptable. And you're thinking, what was that?
Yes.
Same as smoking. Same as smoking will be.
But then the other thing that's gone alongside that is legislation, isn't it? And, you know, I think without some legislation, we've got things like ESG that have come into place that certainly large companies have to report on. And, you know, again, we've seen the impact of that. But I think that'll be where the tipping point comes, you know, because companies often, unless they're measured on it, it's very difficult to really take it seriously.
That is true. That is true. But it is important because it's one thing, whether you're at home or your work, you've got to be, you know, feeling pretty tip top. That's what you want, at least not in a state of peril.
Absolutely. Well, do you know, Russ, I'm feeling pretty tip-top having talked to you today. Thank you so much. And I always find every time I speak to you, I remember you have such a lovely voice. I'm sure this is a completely non-PC thing to say.
I'm not PC at all. Don't get me started on cancel culture. Please don't.
But Russ, thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. I was very, very flattered and delighted and quite surprised. But thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Thank you. And we will see you soon. Cheers.
I look forward to it.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the Podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends and family. Reset the Podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson, with me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny. Music provided by Audio Network.